history of Vietnam, U.S. involvement in Vietnam?
That's right. I hadn't really meant to bring my daughter, but on the second occasion at all, she was only 10, but she had complained about being left in the car when I went up to do some last-minute Xeroxing with Robert. And once she was up there, she complained about being given nothing to do. So we gave her scissors. And when, by mistake, the police came to the door for the second time during this project, because the owner of the shop had not turned the key correctly, and it set off an alarm in the police station. So when the police arrived at the door, they found my son, who was 13 at that time, Mike Robert, was running the Xerox machine, and I was collating on the floor various copies we were making, and Mary, who was 10, was cutting Top Secret off the tops and bottoms of the pages with the scissors, kind of a family project, so they saw how innocent it was, and they left. But my objective with my son in particular was to let him see that there were times when the best thing you could do, you really needed to say no to a government policy, even at the risk of prison. And I wanted him to see that I had not gone off my nut, as I would be described shortly, I was sure, that I was not acting as a traitor or fanatically or hysterically. I was just doing something in a business-like way that I felt had to be done, even though it had a risk. I wanted to plant that idea in his life, and it took hold, as it did with my daughter. My son is the editor-in-chief of Orbis Books, the Catholic seminary liberation theology publishing house, and my daughter is head of Violence Against Women Project, a worldwide project at American University, both of them having been arrested at various times. So,
and you wanted them to know this because you recognized that this could be among the last time you were spending
with them. I would see them. Yes, I thought they'd otherwise just see me through heavy glass in a prison, and would have the way that Julian Assange has had to grow up with his young sons in his total security prison in Belmarsh for having facilitated truth-taking of the same kind that I've done. As a matter of fact, his is the first prosecution of a journalist for putting information out, and it will not be the last if he's successfully extradited over here. So he has a couple of children who've seen him literally only in prison, and better than not seeing him at all. That's certainly the case. But I revealed this year that I had the information from Julian Assange, essentially, that Chelsea Manning had given Assange, and which was later put out in the papers. I had that before the papers, before the newspapers had them, meaning that I was as indictable right now as I'm talking to you as any of the people who've been indicted by this Justice Department, because they're working with a law whose plain language is, on the one hand, unconstitutional from the point of view of the First Amendment, but read properly just says that anyone who reads or handles or stores a piece of paper that has been marked to be protected, marked classified by the government, is subject to imprisonment. That implies even to readers of the New York Times, and very definitely to journalists like Charlie Savage or the publishers or Julian himself. In other words, in that respect, we've gone backwards since that day. That was, after all, mine was the first prosecution of anyone for telling the truth to the American people. And there have been several dozen since. And the first one of a journalist, actually, is, I think, just preceding the first one of a reader before we get there. So this law, the Espionage Act, very much needs to be repealed or rescinded in such a way that it does not serve like a British Official Secrets Act, which was a perfect law for an empire.
Daniel Ellsberg, Pentagon Papers whistleblower, speaking in April. He died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. When we come back, Dan Ellsberg talks about Ukraine, China, the threat of nuclear war, and more. Back in 30 seconds.
I want to thank you, Daniel Ellsberg, for all the notes that came from you.
Thank You, Daniel Ellsberg, by Blood Rock. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we remember Pentagon Papers whistleblower Dan Ellsberg, who died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. His actions helped take down President Nixon and the war in Vietnam, lead to a major victory for press freedom. Over the past half century, Ellsberg remained an anti-war and anti-nuclear activist who inspired a new generation of whistleblowers. We return now to our interview in April, when I asked Dan about the latest leak of Pentagon documents by 21-year-old Air National Guard member Jack Teixeira, who was indicted last week on 6 counts of willful retention and transmission of classified information. I asked Dan Ellsberg about what the leaks say about the war in Ukraine.
It's shown from the reaction to these leaks, the major leak being, once again, like the Pentagon Papers, that when a war appears to be stalemated, it may be stalemated from the inside just as well. That's what the Pentagon Papers showed, that there is no real prospect for progress and that killing people is on either side unjustified by any prospect of any humane result. Intelligence estimates have shown that a year from now, we will probably be in pretty much the same positions, a stalemate, and will not be willing to negotiate. What does that say about the people who are making our foreign policy? If that doesn't define a crisis, an emergency, what would? Well, yes, I suppose the prospect that we're about to lose within a month, and that's not what either is facing yet. I don't want to test how either side reacts if they're facing that. If the U.S. were to do what Biden is urged to do by many, which is to direct U.S. participation in the war, shooting Russians, as I say, for the first time since 1920, two years after the First World War ended, we were still shooting at Russians against Bolsheviks in 1920. Every Russian knows that. How many Americans know that? Any? So that they have that very much in their memory. When Biden is urged to send direct planes that Ukrainians can't yet operate, like the F-16, tanks that they cannot yet operate. The tendency to send Americans to operate those tanks and get them right away into business will be very strong along with that. I can only hope that Biden will be pressed by a large part of the public, pressed not to involve the U.S. directly in that war and to be pursuing negotiations, which it is currently absolutely eschewing, is rejecting the idea of negotiations. There's increasing information that 1 year ago, in early April 2022, Zelensky and Putin essentially had an agreement, within very close to an agreement, on a pre-war status quo, returning to a pre-war status quo in Crimea, in the Donbas, in relation to NATO and everything else, but that the U.S. and the British, Boris Johnson, went over that and said, we are not ready for that. We want the war to continue. We will not accept a negotiation. I would say that was a crime against humanity. And I say that with all seriousness, to the idea that we needed to see people killed on both sides in order, quote, to weaken the Russians. Not for the benefit of Ukrainians, but for an overall geopolitical strategy, was wicked. And however the war started, and I think with both incredibly bad judgment by Putin and aggression and atrocity, and on the other hand, provocation by the United States in the sense of policies that were consciously foreseen to increase the probability of a Russian crime of this sort, tells me that I think there were a lot of Americans who wanted this war, and they got exactly what they wanted, even better than they could have imagined. Huge arms sales to our allies, the U.S. again having an essential role in Europe with an indispensable enemy, an enemy that we could not run the world without Russia. And Russia stepped into that role very willingly. To say that Russia had no choice but to do what they did do is fairly absurd. That's like saying you can provoke a person to shoot themselves in the foot, or in this case, to kneecap themselves. Putin had no choice but to kneecap himself and to give himself 800 more miles of adversarial border with Finland and to resuscitate NATO and get these arms sales and so forth. It's just absurd.
I also wanted to bring up China, because in 2021, you revealed that the government had drawn up plans to attack China with nuclear weapons over a crisis in the Taiwan Strait. Can you talk about the relevance of that today, and when you got that information?
Yes. I revealed that information right after The Economist magazine had a cover with Taiwan on the cover and a big bull mark on front of it, showing that it was, quote, the most dangerous place in the world at that point. And what was at stake was a U.S. intervention in the politics of China, namely supporting a secession movement, an independence movement, by a portion of China regarded almost universally by Chinese as part of China, supporting it in a way which the Chinese were totally forecasting would lead to war, that they would not accept it any more than Lincoln accepted the secession of the Confederacy in this case. And we were pressing for that in a way that I have to say I can't entirely understand. People act as if they want war with China. How can that be? Selling them arms? Yes, I see that. But why they want to change the relation of Taiwan, which has been pretty much the same since 1979, right now, in a way that the Chinese guarantee us will lead to war, is inscrutable to me.
And you said that these nuclear war plans over the Taiwan Straits were made in 1958?
58. Yeah, that's right. And by the way, there was almost a corresponding crisis earlier in 1954-55. So this was known as the second Taiwan crisis in the 50s. But the idea there was that we would initiate nuclear war if the Chinese successfully bombarded by artillery islands that were within artillery range, actually within visual range of the mainland, very easy. A couple of them are just a mile and a mile and a half off from the mainland, to keep those rocks from control by Beijing. We were prepared to send in U.S. planes that block that group blockade, send in U.S. ships to break that blockade. And if the artillery kept that off, or there was a danger of losing U.S. ships, we would hit Chinese targets as much as far away as Shanghai, which would certainly, in Eisenhower's terms, and who okayed this, If necessary to get through to those islands, we would initiate nuclear war. And he foresaw that as leading to Russian, the ally of China, attacks on Taiwan and on Okinawa, on Guam, even on Japan, which in turn guaranteed, in terms of our planning, all-out nuclear war, hitting every city in Russia and China, killing, as our estimates were at that time, 600 million people.
And their relevance today?
Over Taiwan. And that's what they were planning to do then. The number of targets in China has not reduced since then. That was a time when any fighting with the Russians under Eisenhower, even if it started over Berlin, was guaranteed to include targeting China as well. That may have changed to some extent, but to a large extent, at various times, we've still continued to say, shouldn't we have a plan for war with Russia that doesn't include destroying China? To which the answer is, well, do you really want to destroy Russia and not China also? We'll be destroyed in the process. That would leave China ruling the world. In short, Russia and China have to be regarded as a joint target complex. Okay, this is insanity. This is a form of insanity, as a kind of myth and hoax that has taken over the public. It is as insane as QAnon, or as the belief that Trump is the president currently of the United States, and yet the belief that we can do less bad by striking first than if we strike second is what confronts us in Ukraine with a real possibility of a nuclear war coming out of this conflict. In other words, of most life on Earth, not all, most life on Earth being extinguished as a matter of the control of Crimea or the Donbas or Taiwan. That's insane.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg speaking on Democracy Now! In April, soon after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. He died Friday at the age of 92. In December 2017, Dan Ellsberg joined us to talk about his book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. In 1961, Dan Ellsberg was a consultant for the Pentagon and the White House, where he drafted President John F. Kennedy's Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's plans for nuclear war.
So you made copies of top secret reports for plans about nuclear war years before you copied the Pentagon Papers and released them to the press?
Essentially my notes and sometimes verbatim excerpts, not the entire plans themselves, but on plans that were then unknown to the president. To begin with, to President Kennedy, I briefed his aide, McGeorge Bundy, in his first month in office on the nature of the plans and some of the other problems, like the delegation of authority to theater commanders for nuclear war by President Eisenhower, which was fairly shocking to McGeorge Bundy, even though Kennedy chose to renew that delegation, as other presidents have. But I was given the job of improving the Eisenhower plans, which was not a very high bar, actually, at that time, because they were, on their face, the worst plans in the history of warfare. A number of people who saw them, but very few civilians ever got a look at them. In fact, the Joint Chiefs couldn't really get the targets out of General LeMay at the Strategic Air Command. And there was a good reason for that. They were insane. They called for first strike plans, which was by order of President Eisenhower. He didn't want any plan for limited war of any kind with the Soviet Union under any circumstances, because that would enable the Army to ask for enormous numbers of divisions or even tactical nuclear weapons to deal with the Soviets. So he required that the only plan for fighting Soviets under any circumstances, such as an encounter in the Berlin corridor, the access to West Berlin, or over Iran, which was already a flashpoint at that point, or Yugoslavia, if they'd gone in. However the war started, with an uprising in East Germany, for example, however it got started, Eisenhower's directed plan was for all-out war in a first initiation of nuclear war, assuming the Soviets had not used nuclear weapons. And that plan called, in our first strike, for hitting every city, actually every town, over 25,000, in the USSR, and every city in China. A war with Russia would inevitably involve immediate attacks on every city in China. In the course of doing this, there were no reserves. Everything was to be thrown as soon as it was available. It was a vast trucking operation of thermonuclear weapons over to the USSR, but not only the USSR. The captive nations, the East Europe satellites in the Warsaw Pact, were to be hit in their air defenses, which were all near cities, their transport points, their communications of any kind. So they were to be annihilated as well. I couldn't believe when I saw these that the Joint Chiefs actually had ever calculated how many people they would actually kill in this course. In fact, colonels who were friends of mine in the air staff told me they'd never seen an actual figure for the total casualties. We had exact figures of the number of targets and how many planes would be needed and every sort of thing, many calculations, but not victims. So I drafted a question which the aide to McGeorge Bundy, Bob Comer, sent to the Joint Chiefs in the name of the president. And the question was, in the event of your carrying out your general nuclear war plans, which were first strike plans, how many will die? First, I asked, in the USSR and China alone. In the thought that, by the way, they'd be embarrassed to discover, to say, we have to have more time. We've never really calculated that. I was wrong.
and my friends were wrong in the Air Force. They came back with an answer very quickly. 325 million people in the USSR and China alone. Well, then I asked, all right, how many altogether? And a few days later, 100 million in East Europe, the captive nations, another 100 million in West Europe, our allies, from our own strikes, by fallout, depending on which way the wind blew. And however the wind blew, a third 100 million in adjoining countries, neutral countries like Austria and Finland, or Afghanistan then, Japan, northern India, and so forth, a total of 600 million people. That was a time, by the way, when the population of the world was 3 billion. And that was an underestimate of their casualties, 100 Holocausts. It was very clear that they hadn't included, I hadn't asked actually, what would Russian retaliation be against us and against West Europe. They were thought at that time, wrongly, to have hundreds of weapons against the U.S., but they did have hundreds of weapons against West Europe. No question West Europe would go under any circumstances. If we were defending West Europe, Germany, for example, we were planning to destroy the continent in order to save it. 600 million, that was 100 Holocausts. And when I held the piece of paper in my hand that had that figure, that they'd sent out unembarrassedly, you know, proudly to the president, here's what we will do, I thought, this is the most evil plan that has ever existed. It's insane. The weapons, the machinery that will carry this out, this is no hypothetical plan like Herman Kahn might have conceived at the doomsday machine that he thought up at the Rand Corporation, as my colleague. This was an actual war plan for how we would use the existing weapons, many of which I'd seen already that time.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Dan Ellsberg speaking on Democracy Now! In December 2017 about his book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner. 2 years later, in 2019, I spoke to Daniel Ellsberg a day after the Justice Department charged WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange with 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act for publishing U.S. military and diplomatic documents exposing U.S. war crimes. Assange, who's locked up in the Belmarsh prison in London, faces up to 175 years in prison if extradited to the U.S. and convicted here.
Yesterday is a day that will live in the history of journalism, of law in this country, and of civil liberties in this country, because it was a direct attack on the First Amendment, an unprecedented one. There hasn't actually been such a significant attack on the freedom of the press, and the First Amendment, which is the bedrock of our republic, really, our form of government, since my case in 1971, 48 years ago. But this is, I was indicted as a source. And I warned newsmen then that that would not be the last indictment of a source if I were convicted. Well, I wasn't convicted. The charges were dropped on governmental misconduct, and it was another 10 years before anybody else faced that charge under the Espionage Act again, Samuel Loring Morrison. And it was not until President Obama that 9 cases were brought, as I'd been warning for so long. But my warning really was that it wasn't going to stop there. Almost inevitably, there would be a stronger attack directly on the foundations of journalism against editors, publishers, and journalists themselves. And we've now seen that as of yesterday. That's a new front in President Trump's war on the free press, which he regards as the enemy of the people.
And the Trump administration saying Julian Assange is not a publisher, is not a journalist, that's why he is not protected by the First Amendment.
In the face of this new indictment, which—and let me correct something that's been said just a little wrong by everybody so far. He doesn't just face 170 years. That's for the 17 counts on the Espionage Act, each worth 10. Plus, he's still facing the 5-year conspiracy charge that he started out with a few weeks ago. I was sure that the administration did not want to keep Julian Assange in jail just for 5 years. So I've been expecting these Espionage Act charges. I really expected them later after he was extradited, because adding them now makes it a little more complicated for Britain to extradite him now, as I understand it. They're not supposed to extradite for political offenses or for political motives. And this is obviously for both political motives and political offenses. So from Julian Assange's point of view, it makes extradition a little more difficult. Why then did they bring it right now? Well, coming back to the case, by the way, that I faced only 11 Felony Act charges, each worth 10 years in prison, plus a conspiracy charge worth 5. So I was facing exactly 115 years in prison. He's facing exactly 175. Now, that's not a difference that makes any difference. In both cases, it's a question of a life sentence. I think that the reason they brought these charges so soon, because they had until June 12th, was to lay out, the necessity to lay out for extradition all the charges they planned to bring. And I don't assume these are the last ones. They've got a couple weeks left to string up some new charges. They started out with a charge that made Julian look something other than a normal journalist. The help to hacking a password sounded like something that even in the digital age, perhaps most journalists wouldn't do, and that would hope to separate him from the support of other journalists. In this case, when they had to lay out their larger charge, this is straight journalism. They mentioned, for instance, that he solicited investigative material. He solicited classified information terribly. He didn't just passively receive it over the transom. I can't count the number of times I've been solicited for classified information, starting with the Pentagon Papers, but long after that, and that's by every member of the responsible press that I dealt with, the Times, the Post, AP, you name it. That's journalism. So what they have done is recognizable, I think, this time to all journalists that they are in the crosshairs of this one. They may not have known enough about digital performance to help a source conceal her identity by using new passwords, as Julian was charged with. They may not be able to do that, but every one of them has eagerly received classified information and solicited it.
We end our show with Daniel Ellsberg in his own words, May 18th, 2018, when I spoke to him at a Right Livelihood Laureate gathering at University of California, Santa Cruz. I asked him what message he had for government insiders who are considering becoming whistleblowers.
My message to them is, don't do what I did. Don't wait till the bombs are actually falling or thousands more have died before you do what I wish I'd done years earlier in 64 or even 61 on the nuclear issue, and that is reveal the truth that you know, the dangerous truths that are being withheld by the government at whatever cost to yourself, whatever risk that may take. Consider doing that because a war's worth of lives may be at stake. Or in the case of the two existential crises I'm talking about, the future of humanity is at stake. So many graduating classes, I think, have been told year after year for half a century that they face a crossroads or that much depends on what they do. That's no exaggeration right now. It's this generation, not the next one, that the people living right now that have to change these problems fast. And I think truth-telling is crucial to mobilize that.
Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg died Friday at the age of 92, just months after being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. Our deepest condolences to his family, his wife Patricia, his children Robert, Mary, and Michael, his grandchildren, and his great-granddaughter. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thank you for joining us.
The National Indigenous Peoples Day celebration is happening once again. It's a free outdoor event at Moody Park in New Westminster. It's happening on Wednesday, June 21st from 9:30 a.m. till 2 p.m. There's going to be local vendors, food and beverages, live cultural entertainment, storytelling, and many fun activities. The 2023 National Indigenous Peoples Day celebration is hosted by Spirit of the Children's Society, Kakite First Nation, and the City of New Westminster. Also supported by Shop First Nations, the Department of Canadian Heritage, the City of Burnaby, New West Record, New Westminster Teachers Union, the Arts Council of New Westminster, and Metro Vancouver.